3. Worlds in Collision. The Parker Raid marked the moment in history when the westernmost tendrils of the nascent American Empire touched the easternmost tip of a vast, primitive, and equally lethal inland empire dominated by the Comanche Indians. No one understood this at the time. Certainly, the Parkers had no notion of what they were dealing with. Neither the Americans nor the Indians they confronted along that raw frontier had the remotest idea of the other's geographical size or military power. Both, as it turned out, had for the past two centuries been busily engaged in the bloody conquest and near extermination of Native American tribes. Both had succeeded in hugely expanding the lands under their control. The difference was that the Comanches were content with what they had won. The Anglo-Americans, children of manifest destiny, were not. Now, at this lonely spot by the Navasota River, the relentless American drive westward had finally brought them together. The meaning of their meeting, and the moment itself, became completely clear only in hindsight. Though the idea would have astonished Texas settlers of the time, the Comanche horsemen who rode up to the front gate of Parker's Fort that morning in May 1836 were representatives of a military and trade empire that covered some 240,000 square miles, essentially the southern Great Plains. Their land encompassed large chunks of five present-day states: Texas, New Mexico, Colorado, Kansas, and Oklahoma. It was crossed by nine major rivers, stair-stepped north to south across 600 miles of mostly level plains and prairie. In descending order, they were the Arkansas, Cimarron, Canadian, Washita, Red, Pease, Brazos, Colorado, and Pecos. If you counted the full reach of Comanche raiding parties, which ranged deep into Mexico and as far north as Nebraska, their territory was far bigger than that. It was not an empire in the traditional sense, and the Comanche knew nothing of the political structures that stitched European empires together. But they ruled the place outright. They held sway over some 20 different tribes who had been either conquered, driven off, or reduced to vassal status. In North America, their only peers, in terms of sheer acreage controlled, were the Western Sioux, who dominated the northern plains. Such imperial dominance was no accident of geography. It was the product of over 150 years of deliberate, sustained combat against a series of enemies over a singular piece of land that contained the country's largest buffalo herds. Those adversaries included the colonial Spanish, who had driven north into New Mexico in 1598 and later into the Texas Territory, and their Mexican successors. They included a host of native tribes and a dozen tribes who contested for supremacy on the buffalo ranges, among them Apaches, Utes, Osages, Pawnees, Tonkawas, Navajos, Cheyennes, and Arapahos. The empire was not based solely on military supremacy. The Comanches were diplomatically brilliant, too, making treaties of convenience when it suited them, and always looking to guarantee themselves trade advantages, particularly in that most tradable of all commodities on the plains, horseflesh, of which they owned more than anyone. One sign of their domination was that their language, a Shoshone dialect, became the lingua franca of the southern plains, much as Latin had been the commercial language of the Roman Empire. Considering all of this, it was just short of amazing that the Anglo-Americans, in the year 1836, knew so little about the Comanches. The Spanish, who fought them for more than a century, knew a great deal, though even they did not suspect the full scope of the empire. As late as 1786, the Spanish governor of New Mexico still believed that the Comanche stronghold was in Colorado, when in fact they had established supremacy as far south as the San Saba country of Texas, some 500 miles away. This is partly because the European mind simply could not comprehend the distances the average Comanche could travel. The nomadic range of their bands was around 800 miles. Their striking range, this confused the insurgent populations as much as anything, was 400 miles. That meant that a Spanish settler or soldier in San Antonio was in grave and immediate danger from a Comanche brave sitting before a fire in the equivalent of modern-day Oklahoma City. It took years before anyone understood that the same tribe that was raiding on the plains of Durango, Mexico, was also riding above the Arkansas River in modern-day Kansas. But by 1836, of course, the Spanish were long gone, replaced by Mexicans who had even less success dealing with Comanches, who contemptuously referred to them as their stock keepers. It was one of history's great ironies that one of the main reasons Mexico had encouraged Americans to settle in Texas in the 1820s and 1830s was because they wanted a buffer against Comanches, a sort of insurance policy on their borderlands. In that sense, the Alamo, Goliad, San Jacinto, and the birth of the Texas Republic were the product of a misguided scheme to stop the Comanches. No one knew this either, certainly not settlers like the Parkers, who were, in effect, being offered up as meat for Comanche raiders. Still, encounters at that point between whites and Comanches had been extremely rare. Lewis and Clark knew the tribe only by hearsay. Lewis wrote about the Great Paducah Nation, Paducah was believed to be another name for Comanche, that occupied the country between the upper parts of the River Platte, present Nebraska, and the River Kansas. He goes on to say that, of the Paducah, there does not now even exist the name. They were thus just a rumor, and perhaps not even that. In 1724, the French trader Étienne Vignard de Bourgmont visited the Paducahs and described them as not entirely wandering, they are partially sedentary, for they have villages with large houses and do some planting. Since there was never such a thing as a sedentary village-dwelling Comanche, it is likely that the Paducahs were something altogether different, quite possibly plains-dwelling Apaches, though it is impossible to prove. In the 1820s, Stephen F. Austin and his first group of Anglo-Texas settlers encountered the Comanches, and Austin was even briefly held captive by them. They seemed otherwise friendly enough, and nothing came of it. The first pack trains moved down the Santa Fe Trail in 1821, connecting Missouri to New Mexico with a route that crossed Kansas, Colorado, and Oklahoma. Total traffic, however, averaged only about 80 wagons a year. Some were attacked by Indians, but in those years, white people moving down a trail were not to be confused with settlers who actually wanted to hold land. The trail was merely a thin ribbon of commerce that jeopardized neither hunting grounds nor traditional lands, and reports of Comanche attacks were probably exaggerated. Contact was minimal, and in any case, the traders found it hard to tell one Indian from another. In 1832, Sam Houston, then working as a trader with the Cherokees, made an unsuccessful trip to Texas to try to make peace among Comanches, Osages, and Pawnees. In 1834, a troop of 250 mounted dragoons under Colonel Richard Dodge made contact with them above the Red River. According to the description of George Catlin, a well-known artist and chronicler of the West who was with Dodge, the Americans were dazzled by Comanche horsemanship, their prowess from horseback with a bow and arrow, and their ability to break wild mustangs. Catlin even speculated, hilariously in retrospect, that it is probable that in a few days we will thrash them. He had no clue what he was talking about. In battle, the Comanches would have likely cut the ridiculously clad, heavily mounted, and musket-firing dragoons to ribbons. W.S. Nye wrote that the soldiers were attired in costumes better suited to comic opera than to summer field service in Oklahoma. But these encounters offered little or no information about the true nature of the tribe. Their history, numbers, and limits are still in obscurity, wrote Catlin at the time. Nothing definite yet is known of them. Just how obscure they were, as late as 1852, is apparent in the account of an expedition to the headwaters of the Red River by Captain Randolph Marcy, published in 1853. He describes the country, which was at the time the core of the Comanche Empire, fully 16 years after Parker's Fort, as a completely unexplored place no white man had ever ascended, and as unknown to Americans as the darkest regions of Africa. It should be noted that the Comanches and Kiowas who raided Parker's fort were mounted. Indians riding horses may seem obvious enough to us now, but to Americans in the early 19th century, the phenomenon was quite new. In spite of the indelible image of whooping, befeathered savages on horseback, most Indians in the Americas were footbound. There were no horses at all on the continent until the Spanish introduced them in the 16th century. Their dispersal into wild Mustang herds was exclusively a Western event, confined to the plains and to the Southwest, and accruing almost entirely to the benefit of the aboriginal inhabitants of those areas. This meant that no soldier or settler east of the Mississippi, going back to the first settlers, had ever encountered a mounted Indian warrior. There simply weren't any. As time went by, of course, Eastern Indians learned to ride horses, but that was long after they had surrendered, and no Eastern, Midwestern, or Southern Native American tribe ever rode into battle. The first settlers ever to see true horse Indians were the Texans, because it was in Texas where human settlement first arrived at the edges of the Great Plains. The Indians they encountered were primitive nomads and superb riders, nothing at all like the relatively civilized, largely agrarian, village-dwelling tribes of the East, who traveled and fought on foot and presented easy targets for white militias and armies. The horse Indians lived beyond the forests in an endless, trackless, and mostly waterless expanse of undulating grass that was terrifying to white men. They resembled less the Algonquins or the Choctaws than the great and legendary mounted archers of history, Mongols, Parthians, and Magyars.